remember when we first started this whole podcast thing, we just came up with the name God Journey. Some people didn't like it. I think it's perfect. This is not about me. This is not my journey. I am a supporting actor in a greater drama that's going on. This is about him.
Thinking outside the box isn't about whether you go to a meeting or not. It's about breaking free of the obligations of religious performance and living in the adventure of a relationship with God as our Father.
Two real guys talking about life, that's a good tagline.
Slinging freedom all over the place and making no apologies, this is The God Journey.
I'm Brad Cummings.
And I'm Wayne Jacobson.
And how's it being, Wayne Jacobson?
Boy, these days are rough.
Your inbox is being stuffed with...
No, the inbox isn't too bad these days, actually, but just...
it's the outbox.
It's the medical stuff and the life stuff and...
Just, you got any results?
No, I don't, actually. My doctor went out of town and said...
left you hanging!
Some kind of family emergency. He was supposed to call me on Friday. He didn't. They got the results, but, you know, I don't have a clue what they are, so...
That's probably better news.
I guess they're not overly concerned.
No, I have to just take a vacation and we'll get back to you.
Yeah, so hopefully that sorts out. But
thanks for the photo shoot.
Yeah, but I'm still having some sign of symptomatic thing. It says something needs to be addressed somewhere in my life, and so we'll figure out what those are. The severe ones are not there, so that's good. But there's some other things going on that leads me away from what they were thinking. But you know, you never know.
Take two aspirin, couple of prayers.
Or I get a healing. So
check the doctor.
Me and Jesus are talking about it too, so we'll see what the great physician has in mind.
Oh, you got something hot off the press.
No, go ahead.
No. You just were shaking it.
I just noticed this in the paper. I thought you would enjoy this. A Utah State University psychology professor is studying a treatment for a disorder that causes obsession with morality and religion.
An obsession
with
morality and religion.
Yeah, that's interesting.
I might have that.
I don't think you do.
No, I don't have that. No.
This is a study on people who are obsessed with strictly adhering to a religious or moral code in a way that is debilitating. People who suffer from the problem pray for hours or confess sins they only imagine they committed out of desire to exactly follow their religion. It's called scrupulosity. And many people who suffer from this disorder...
Scrupulosity?
Don't even attend church regularly. So this isn't about church attendance. This is just about somebody that gets so hunkered down into fitting this moral code, it becomes an obsessive disorder. I've known people like this. I've known people who were so...
Oh, I've pastored people like that.
Yeah, so Jesus-y. And everybody else thinks they're the model example of what it is to be a conservative.
I'm not so sure anymore.
No, it's not. It's actually a disorder.
But I don't think there's that many people that look at that and go like, yeah, that's exactly how I want my life to be emulated. People sometimes like they like going to church to get that good spanking. Pastor really gave it to us. I go like, and you like that?
Yeah.
But there is. I mean, I think for some people, is that sense of catharsis. I know there's something wrong. I don't know what to do about it.
I should try harder.
I like being affirmed that this is the right thing, and then they try to deal with it, I guess, in scrupulosity.
Well, that's the more extreme version, I think. I think other people just like being flagellated every Sunday morning for their inactivity or inability.
Or they sit there thinking everyone else is getting flagellated, and they're kind of like, yeah,
you need to say that, Pastor. That's how I was. I know I'm working hard. I don't know what the rest of people are. If you want to wail on those people, go right on ahead. So.
We're getting dinged for laughing too much.
No, one person. You know, it amazes me. We must get 5 emails a week how we could make this a better podcast. Stop laughing. Stop taking things humorously.
I'm sorry. My life is at a different decibel that I need a good laugh every now and then.
You know, I just started listening to your podcast, but it'd be better if you blah, 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 blah. Gee, really? We're not trying to do a podcast. I think that people really misunderstand.
It's not the Wayne and Brad show.
We're having a conversation about our journey, and other people have enjoyed listening in on it, and we're not... I don't know. We're trying to make this anything. We don't have production meetings, pre-show meetings where we talk about how we do it better, how we grow the audience, how we. It just really, it's a conversation. If you enjoy it, great. If you want to try and fix it.
If you don't, listen to something else. It's quite fine.
It really is not that big of, not shouldn't be that big of a problem anyway. So.
You don't have a fan page?
I don't.
I don't.
I'm and somebody wrote me this week and said, you know, your friend list is getting pretty big on Facebook. You need to think about a fan page. And I go, the problem with the fan page is people are called fans. I don't want fans. I don't have fans. I don't want fans.
I like fans when it's hot.
So I'm going to have someday have a live stream page people can like. And I can do updates there, I guess. But, yeah, I don't know what I'm going to do. I hope someone out there knows Facebook better than I. Cause
you know what? You just defriend people so you get below that threshold.
Believe me, there's a lot of people on my friend list. I don't have a clue who they are. So
they're not really great friends?
That would be easy. But, yeah, I mean, I don't know that I did Facebook right, to be honest. I wish I would have kept the one page. It was just family, close friends, people that, you know, you cared about, knowing when they're having the next cup of coffee. Of course, that would be very small to people. And then there's
the other. You don't drink coffee, so you wouldn't have any posts on that.
I really wouldn't care. And then now people tell you, so-and-so just checked into Starbucks. Yeah, that's where you are. People don't realize how much they're being manipulated by these things to be advertisers. You're using your life to be a product placement. The Truman Show is coming to pass.
Yeah, you know.
You don't have to be on video to use you for
that. You know what disturbs me is the agreement on that. All of that material is theirs.
Yeah.
Well, I don't put anything on there. You can't take my stuff.
I notice you don't put anything on there.
I don't put anything on there. I'm not giving them my stuff.
I don't blame you.
Yeah, I just kind of quietly sit there like, okay, whatever.
I put a picture.
Glad to have so many friends.
I put a picture of my new puppy up. Got lots of response.
That's marvelous.
They can have that picture of my puppy. I just have
given. My wife's addicted to Facebook, though.
Well, some people really enjoy it.
She does?
It's a real connection.
Sorry, honey.
So that'll be the next Facebookosity. It will be the next obsessive compulsive disorder that they probably aren't already studying it.
Well, you can spend endless hours a day just checking it. Just going back, checking, see what's new.
Yeah, I don't.
You know what's so strange? I mean, I'm standing in the line at Starbucks, and here's this whole line of people, and virtually 80% of them are all staring at their phone. It's going like, this is so weird. Got a bunch of sleepy people looking for coffee, staring at their phones, and you could have a whole bunch of great conversations. I mean, like, I know people in there, and so it's fun to stop by and have a little conversation. But everyone else is kind of like, it's sort of like their privacy. Like, you know, don't bother me. I'm busy. I'm doing my phone thing. And he's like,
is that what it is, you think?
I don't know.
Are people just having anything else to do, so they're looking at their Facebook and they're looking at their email and they're looking at the sports page? And
I think it has replaced the newspaper.
No, it has replaced the newspaper.
It's just kind of like, because.
But as a shield?
I think so. Yep, I got my phone up. Sorry.
Oh, man.
I don't know.
I don't know either.
It gives communication at one level, but then it really takes away from the personal interaction stuff.
Yeah.
I tried to call the family to dinner the other night.
Text them.
So I did. I did.
Yeah.
What? I did. I told everyone, dinner's ready. It's on the table. I hate eating cold food. So finally, I just got my phone. I texted each and every one of them. And I showed them a picture of dinner. I sent a picture to them.
Yeah, I might try that next time, because my family was over here on Sunday. And I told them we'd be ready in 2 minutes for dinner, which I thought meant, you know, get the kids potted and do all that stuff so we can actually eat the food while it's warm. When I finally brought it in.
You like warm food, too?
I do. When I brought it in from the barbecue, everybody's like, okay, now you got to wash your hands. You got to go potty. You got to go. Oh, great. Another 5 minutes later, food's cooling off. Okay, so the two-minute warning didn't mean anything.
No,
the two-minute warning, Dad. I didn't know a two-minute warning. So maybe next time they get a text. We got kicked off Kate's jogging program.
We were on Kate's jogging program?
Yeah, we were. Kate wrote me this morning and said, start listening to you guys about a year ago.
I knew I was tired.
After reading So You Don't Want to Church Tomorrow, I plug in after I finish my run during my cool down each morning. I had to stop listening to you when I was running because I inevitably, something you would say would force me to stop running, sometimes even stop and weep as your conversation would ignite and release from my inaccurate assumptions about what it means to trust, to live loved, and most recently to develop righteousness by simply nurturing trust instead of achieving performance-based activities. Wow, she was listening.
We got it. That's a prophetic parable right there, getting off the treadmill.
Oh, yeah. The podcast for your cool down.
There you go.
That's what we need.
The cool down.
She said, I still love and look forward to attending church each week in the traditional programmed formal meeting-based theatrical sense. See, I'm listening, she says.
Wow.
But I have also discovered that church happens in the briefest encounters every day, and I'm learning to be more present when I enter these divine intersections rather than staring at a phone, I would assume. That's good. I'm learning to be more present when I enter these divine intersections.
Good.
And she goes, divine intersections. That's your next podcast title, guys. I don't know if it is or not. We'll see how the conversation goes. But
I think you just tried it.
It's a good title.
How'd it work?
It's a good title. But Doug says this. Interestingly, I listen to stories of manipulative church histories, and I can't really relate that well. I walked away from an organization which I was raised partially because it seemed like it was just a nice group of folks hanging out for some nice talk for a couple of hours. I could not have told you what they really considered key and essential. Certainly, there didn't seem anything worth dying for or even disrupting Sunday lunch for.
Lukewarm niceness.
So there wasn't much to live for either. Interesting. You know, because we do talk. I come from traditions where a lot of people who spill out of church do so because the pastor became an autocrat. I mean, he just, the man in charge, religious, the man with the vision, everybody's got to serve him or it doesn't work. And there's a certain strain of church in America and probably the world that alienates people at that level. And here's a guy that said, no, it wasn't that. Not any of that, but we got just
boring.
Bored out of my mind. There was a lot of lukewarminess, probably not a real word, in what passes for the body, and call a passionate walk with the Lord doesn't even seem like a bad thing to me. I've heard on this podcast there are some issues you guys are not lukewarm about either. I don't think Father's love for us is lukewarm. Mm-hmm. I think it's radically passionate if he's conforming us to his image. Can it lead to mistakes? Absolutely. And it always seems messy. I heard that same teaching about lukewarm and loving it, and I didn't hear it as a call to guilt and shame, but a plea to stop living a life of a little bit of God and a whole lot of comfortable country living and calling it good. Well, I did listen to a little bit of lukewarm and loving it.
Was that something we said?
No.
I was going to say, I'm not tracking here.
That's a popular online teaching by some folks who've heard it.
Oh, gosh, I should go online.
Actually done by a guy who lives not far from here. But, you know, I think, like anything, communication, how people receive things, very different than maybe how it's being said sometimes. So can people add guilt to things that don't have it? Yeah. Can people not see guilt when it's right in front of them?
Yeah.
I listened to a bit of it, and I tell you, I'm not a judge on these things. I listened to the whole thing, to be honest. I got bored after 5 minutes and went, you know, this really is about just, you know, guilting people up.
Hunker down, raise your commitment level.
And the problem with that for me is, isn't God endearing enough to transform us for himself? The idea that, you know, God's not really working, so, you know, you need to look at how rich you are and how much the world is suffering. And if you're not doing it, you're one of the richest people in the world have ever lived. You should be doing more for God. I'm going, you know what? If God doesn't strike to our heart, why would we even want to use guilt as a tool?
Oh, I go back to the chief end of man is to work hard and serve him forever. No, it's chief end of man is to love God and enjoy him forever. And I don't know that we really make that central. I do know that so much of, in the organized arena of religion, it's like there's a whole commercial aspect that needs to be addressed. We don't somehow want it to be about that, so we don't address it directly. But it's like, I've got to make people do a certain set of stuff to generate the activity of what really makes what we're doing important. And I'm just going like, really? I mean, this other guy was saying, I thought they'd be about that, and they weren't. They weren't giving me a compelling reason to say, hey. And I'm going like, gosh, but maybe what if those people were simply enjoying each other? I kind of go like, that might be wonderful.
It might be. And I think when I read that letter the first time, my thought was, how can you do something every week and keep a sense of intensity about it? You really can't. I mean, time you've done something every week for
that's pretty good.
20, 30 years, you know, crises come and go. And, you know, you can't every day just, you know, blow out the sermon for 4 more hours and sit here in intense prayer all week long because such and such a need is going on around it. I mean, at some point, routine itself kind of lulls us to sleep. That's why I like I like living more in the spontaneity of the moment. If there's a crisis at hand, man, let's get together and do what crisis demands that we do. And if there's an intense time of prayer needed, let's do that. But you can't conjure that up every week. That's what my 6 a.m. prayer meetings when I was pastoring one of these things, because the real spiritual, deep concern people would be there at 6 a.m. on a Tuesday morning. And we pray our eyeballs out. I mean, this intensity you bring to it.
Might be the scrupulosity, folks.
Week after week after week, it just wears out. You cannot maintain by routine and intensity. I think it's got to be demanded by circumstance or demanded by opportunity or occasion. There's a different thing about trying to make something happen and living in what is happening, whether it's desperate or fun and relaxing, you know, in the moment.
I think all of that's pretty hard to try to figure out if you were to try to navigate by religious principles.
Or even just routine. That's kind of what I'm suggesting. One thing I noticed when I read the Gospels, Jesus didn't create events for people to come to.
Nor did he have a routine.
No, he didn't create this, okay, we have this weekly meeting, Friday night Pharisee dialogue, you know, Tuesday night we'll do this. He lived in the world, and when he came across things, he responded to the things he was in. We have this need, I think, I did as a pastor particularly, and I don't think I have the need now so much, but we create this event. We create this event for this purpose, this event for this purpose. And maybe when they start out, there's some intensity and reality and purpose to it. But just the fact that you did it every week and kept doing it every week, eventually wore everybody out, or the intensity was lost, or the purpose was...
I think that is where the necessity of being in dialogue with God's voice being the thing that leads you. If he's not directing that, I do kind of wonder if heaven doesn't look down and go like, gosh, hey, what are you guys doing? I mean, not disparagingly, but just going like, gosh, if he didn't direct them and call them to that, but they called themselves unto that, I would imagine sometimes, you know, the little cloud of witnesses is looking now like, hey, what are they up to?
Well, you've got to
know. Father, are you directing that? And if he would just respond like, no.
Well, in the Old Testament, the prophets especially, you've got lots of things where God actually called them to sacred assemblies. And then he's writing, he's like, I don't even go anymore. They've lost the meaning for which I asked you to do these things. Why do you wear yourselves out? Why do you try to wear me out? And Isaiah does this. A lot of the minor prophets do this. Even things that God asked them to do became meaningless in the routine. And then it no longer served, like you're saying, no longer served God's purpose. It served my need to feel spiritual, so I'll get there at 6 in the morning on Tuesday. Or my need to feel superior to somebody else, so I'm doing this extra bit of whatever. And it ceases then to be, what is God asking us to do? And is this really, even was Isaiah's thing on the fasting, you know, you fast, but then, well, you fast for your own gain. You don't even realize the needy people around you. And fasting isn't breaking your heart with God's reality in the world. Fasting just making you more self-secure in who you are. And God's, that's not the kind of fast I even want. So I do think God gets tired of those things.
Yeah, and I think the challenge is, you know, you look at those things and it's like, well, are they wrong? No, it's not. It's not right or wrong. It's, is God initiating that? And am I responding to his initiative? And I do think that there's also a place in our life with God that when God sometimes says, well, what do you want?
Yeah.
Where he's not dictating it. And I'm not just the little, you know, luggage carrier going like, okay, Lord, what's next? I think there's times that God says, well, what would you like? And I think you got to know the difference of what is he doing, because, gosh, you can get lost in both directions, assuming that the activity that what I'm doing is fruitful and godly.
Yeah, and you got to assume there are times when God says, okay, enough of this. What I asked you to do, let's move on. Yeah, it was a task, it was a thing, it was a moment. I didn't mean for you to caretake this forever. I didn't mean this to become a routine. And the best story I like about that was Catherine the Great of Russia, you know, was particularly brutal winter, goes by some part in what became the Kremlin, and sees the first crocus of spring and assigns a guard to stand over that crocus and guard it so no one picks it or no one crushes it. It was the first hope that winter would be over. And then 200 years later, or 150 years later, the guard's still standing on that spot because, you know, she told the guard to stand there and they've never stopped. And the purpose has long since been lost. And I think religion is notorious for that. And to Christianity especially, we've been doing for 2,000 years.
Garden of Crocus.
Certain rituals and methodologies. And has God moved on? Our living in Him is more about responding in the moments of life with what He's doing, with an ear to Him, doing what we see the Father doing, saying what we hear the Father saying, rather than I've got these routines about my life that make me feel spiritual.
Well, the most often repeated phrase in the New Testament is to him who has ears, let him hear. And you're just going like, well, last time I checked, I got two. Yeah. And that is the biggest challenge. I mean, Jared and I had a wonderful conversation the other day, but he was just getting all kind of confused, I think, in terms of just the whole foolishness of comparison. He's assessing where he's at and in conjunction with – you're sitting there going like, I got a son who I think is exceptional in so many ways. He wasn't seeing it. He was feeling less than and really getting kind of, I think, beat up needlessly. And so we sat down and just kind of, okay, where is it that you get your value and who defines it? Because you certainly get it from someplace, but where might you get it and where would it be accurate? Finally got to the place of the fact that, you know what, dude, you're totally unique. So when you try to compare yourself with others, Bible says, 1 Corinthians, they that do so are unwise. And it's going like, you have your own path. The only one who's going to be able to accurately assess how you're doing is really in your dialogue with God. And it's what he thinks, not what you do, not what even what I do. It's like if he looks down, he says, that's wonderful. Then relax and celebrate that. If he looks down and says, hey, then in spite of everyone else's accolades, guess what? Hey, so good.
Yeah.
And I think that we've lost that sense of a real live dependence upon God's voice because we're so capable of doing a whole bunch of other things without it.
Yeah, for sure. And we learn not to need it. And a lot of people just feel like, well, I never hear it. So God never speaks to me anyway. But it really isn't so much, you know, God, show me what you're doing today. And then God says, well, I'm doing these three things. It's just, you know, and I think people kind of assume that that's what it must be for us. I think it's waking up.
All right, God, I got my day planner.
Leaning into him, knowing we're loved, and watching the day unfold and following the impulses of our heart. Some turn out to be God. Some turn out to be Wayne. Some turn out to be the voice of the enemy. But you learn more and more how to live inside that voice that seems more godlike and less Wayne-like or less indulgent-like.
And less yanking on the chain of shame and jerking you into scrubulosity.
Well, there you go.
Yeah.
Who wants to be jerked in the
I got a new word. I'm going to use it.
I've got a wonderful piece I want to share with you. This probably five different people sent me a link to this. It's a talk on the power of vulnerability by, I don't know how to pronounce her name probably, Dr. Breen or Bren Brown. That's a tough name.
Bren Brown.
I think I would have married somebody with a G or something green instead of a Brown. She may not even be married. That may be her name. I don't know. She's not, as far as I know, not a person of faith, but she is a social researcher, a clinical sociologist, something or other, researcher. And here's the first thing she said.
The power of vulnerability.
Yeah.
From a secular point of view.
From a secular point of view.
Okay. I'm ears.
You'll be blown away by this. And it's a 20-minute talk. We'll link it on the blog. So if you want to hear the talk yourself, you'll be able to do that. This is what first caught my eye. By the time you are a social worker for 10 years, what you realize is that connection is why we're here. It is what gives purpose and meaning to our lives. It doesn't matter whether you talk to people who work in social justice or mental health, abuse or neglect. What we know is that connection, the ability to feel connected, is neurobiologically how we're wired. It is why we're here. Man, I just tell you, that really resonates with God's call to community, call to relationship, what God wants to do in us. And what they're saying is we are all wired to be connected. And yep. We can connect in healthy ways, or we can connect in unhealthy ways. I mean, the whole gang thing, the whole political diatribe thing we got going on, finding people you feel like you belong to, and religion obviously preys on that a lot. And she said, what keeps us from connection? In a word, shame. Shame is easily understood as the fear of being disconnected. Is there something about me that if other people know or see it, that I won't be worthy of connection? It is universal. We all have it. The only people who don't have it have no ability for empathy or human connection.
That's weird that this is coming from, quote, just a secular sociological dynamics. We're completely wired
for connection.
And yet, if I'm hearing it correctly, the impetus behind that is shame.
Yeah. Isn't the echo...
See, I don't like that. I understand that, but I'm going like, no, I think God did wire us. I was excited about the first part. I'm not getting bummed. I mean, I think there's more... But I think it is a bummer that the real impetus is our shame.
No, no, it's not the impetus. It's what keeps us from connection.
Oh.
I think it really harkens back to the fall. We had this incredible connection with God. We take off on our own way. The relationship collapses. We end up shamed. And that sense of shame is just, we don't know if people saw the real me, if I'd be worthy of a connection.
That fear will keep you from vulnerability.
So shame is not the reason for connection. It's the distraction from it. It's the reason we don't have it, which I just go, man, that's brilliant.
That's true.
And she said the only people who don't have shame have no ability for empathy or human connection. We're talking about psychopaths and narcissists and, you know.
How about free Christian?
She doesn't get that.
She doesn't know any.
Which makes me think, because I've been playing with this a lot lately. I believe, I mean, the chapter in He Loves Me, Shamelessly Free. I believe Jesus came to set us free from shame. But the freedom is only in Him. You set a worldly person free from shame?
Yeah, now go shoot someone in Arizona.
And they become a psychopath or a narcissist. I don't think the purpose of God was just, well, I'm going to free you all from shame. I think it's, I want to invite you into me. And I want to disarm your shame when there's something more magnificent to capture your heart than your own selfish indulgence. As long as you're living in selfish indulgence, shame is a gift from God to restrain people's behavior from being too destructive, or it's meant to be. I don't know that shame then is an evil. I think shame keeps us from relationship. It does do that. But if people are not connecting to begin with, then I don't know. I get thinking, man, maybe that whole shame on you thing, or a community shaming somebody for doing wrong or doing ill or lying or being arrogant.
It's meant to be restorative and redemptive. That isn't what typically is applied.
The way shame's been mishandled in religion is a problem. But she said, then what's the key to connection? The power of vulnerability is the name of the talk. She said, vulnerability is the key to connection. People who have a strong sense of worthiness and those who struggle for it. Those who have a strong sense to believe that they are worthy of other people's love. What she calls wholehearted people. They have the courage to be imperfect, compassion to be kind to themselves and others, and connection as a result of their authenticity. She said, what really connects heart to heart is not perfection.
Okay, I'm going to go to her church.
It's authenticity. I don't know if she has one, but you can listen to her.
I wouldn't be surprised.
TED.com. And he said, people who have connections have embraced vulnerability. What made them vulnerable made them beautiful, and their willingness to be vulnerable for others without a guarantee, willingness to invest in a relationship that won't work out, is the key to having healthy connections.
I think that's what guarantees the genuineness as opposed to the self-servingness.
Yeah.
Because I think so oftentimes people look at something and go, well, that's not worth it to me, so I'm not going to do that. And so really our love is very motivated by what benefit do I get out of it. So how is it love for others as opposed to just love for self?
And doesn't hurt make us withdraw from relationships until I have a guarantee that you will treat my love well? And you basically, what she's saying is, when you cease to be vulnerable, when you cease to engage relationships without a guarantee, you will cease to have relationships. She said, by numbing vulnerability, we cannot selectively numb the bad things without numbing the good things. So you numb vulnerability, you also numb joy, gratitude, and happiness, and then we are miserable.
Wow.
When you lose vulnerability, she said, you try to make the uncertain certain. Religion has gone from faith in mystery to false certainty. I'm right, you're wrong, shut up. Wow. How often do you hear that? Oh, my gosh. And then she gets, then she goes into the blame thing. Blame is a way to discharge pain or comfort and put it on someone else. It's a way to discharge your pain.
Oh, man. I think that's the thing in the last couple of weeks, just looking at the whole news cycle, some bad things happen. And I've just watched this incessant need to find fault and attach blame. And I'm just going like, I don't know that any of us know enough to do that in some of these situations. But the endless chatter of this incessant need to do that. And you're just going like, I just was asking, where does that come from?
Somewhere we'll wake up to the reality. If you've got 24-hour news channels that got to have people yelling at each other, being right is not essential to being on cable news.
No, it's not.
Being vitriolic is. And you've got to come to these, like we said about the, you know, football prognosticators. You know, you can be most certain about things that aren't known.
Right.
Because people feel, well, I don't know, maybe he's right. And I do think that whole blame, again, I think so much of this talk from her harkens back to the fall. This innate echo of God's heart in the human soul for connection.
Yeah, hey, and let's go for a walk.
And I think that's first of all got to be fulfilled in God, but there's also a desire, and I think that's what people feel who've left their normal way of doing church is, now I feel unconnected and I don't know what to do. And so the tendency is to jump into some kind of false connection that satiates that, whether it's home church, organic church, or some different kind of way of doing that. And
I don't know that those are false, but that is part of the search for.
They can be. I'm not saying they all are, because some are very very genuine ways of people connecting, and so I appreciate that. But when she says blame is the way to discharge pain or comfort, you go back to the fall, and Adam and Eve start blaming each other from the very start. It wasn't me. It was her. It wasn't me. It was a snake. It wasn't, you know, it was you, God. You gave me this woman. Blame is the way we export our own sense of failure and shame. I believe that's true.
Yeah, I think that is true.
And I think boasting is the same thing. When you boast about yourself, you're still that comparative thing you're talking about with Jared. When you're on the upside of that and you feel like, yeah, I'm good because like I'm better than that guy, better than that guy, better than that guy. Now you've gotten that same.
So? Yeah.
And what it does is it destroys relationships. When you think you're better than someone, when you think you can blame someone for your own unhappiness, you end up miserable, and then you end up less connected, and then you end up more angry that you're not connected, and then you take a gun and go shoot somebody. Mm. I mean, it's really sad.
You said something earlier that I've still just been chewing on. I look at shame, and I'm having a hard time seeing that as a gift from God, as opposed to perhaps just a barometer of reality that says, hey, there's something wrong. And then it's a question of how do you go about addressing that? Because I think shame is, you can have a community put that on you, but if it doesn't ever find root in that own heart, change doesn't happen. I think it's that sense of conscience in us.
Yeah, I think what I mean by it is shame is a reality in the fallen human soul.
Yes.
It is a reality. I think we try to put it on people, quote unquote.
Yeah, that's, you're not doing that's really helpful.
I think the other side of trying to help people falsely, hey, you're great, you're good, buck up.
And that's not really working in our culture either.
No, that to me is creating a nightmare. I think what the Bible is sharing is that when shame is removed in Christ, now there's something greater to replace that shame, to call you to a life better than your own self-indulgence.
Yeah, just throwing it off and becoming a narcissist is not the answer.
Just helping people be shameless, and then they just go, and what she says, they have no empathy for people or no human connection. So you haven't served someone. But you don't realize, but I think that what you're saying, and I agree with, you can't exploit people's shame to bring them into a relationship with God. That will
See,
not
that,
work.
Yeah, the sad reality is, I think, unfortunately, so much of how the gospel gets presented really is driving down that road.
Absolutely.
It's like, I'm going to heighten someone's awareness of their shame. If they're not aware of it, I'm going to point it out.
To manipulate their
And then
behavior.
I'm going to provide the solution. Well, what a nice thing. And he's going like, no.
And the solution is, I can forgive you, so we forgive, but now you have to perform better to earn your forgiveness. That's how that whole thing gets wrapped around the shame thing yet again.
And I think the reality is you get back to the garden, and it's kind of wild. Here's God in the cool of the day coming to just take a walk.
Yep.
Well, when was the last time you did that? When was the last time you concluded that is sort of the central thing? Because I think we've turned religion in the pursuit of God into a purpose-driven, I'm going to use this as my means to get my desired outcome. Whether it's I'm going to feel better about myself, whether it's I'm going to change the culture. I mean,
I'm going to have friends.
Yeah, there's just a whole bunch of things. And I'm going like, you know what? God isn't a tool. He is an end. He is also the means. But if you lose sight of the fact that relationship is what he's longing for, I think then we concoct a whole bunch of things and jump on the treadmill with that other lady where you're just going like, I don't think that's what God's looking for us to do. And yet I find most passionate believers, exhausted people.
Yeah.
Because why? And I can't fill in the blank that says, well, that makes sense.
Well, here's what she says about parenting. And I think it applies to what you're saying right now, just even how we treat other people. Parenting, when you hold these perfect little babies in your hands, our job is not to say, look at her, she's perfect. My job is to keep her perfect, to make sure she makes the tennis team by the fifth grade and Yale by seventh grade. Yeah, she's hilarious. She said, our job is to say, and I love this, you know what? This is to your kids. You know what? You are imperfect and you're wired for struggle, but you are worthy of love and belonging.
That's a good.
Isn't that beautiful?
That's very nice.
Because so many of the emails I get from people who are struggling with really desperate circumstances in their lives, or you know, dealing with our brothers and sisters in Kenya who obviously deal with a systemic desperation of their culture just to even put food on a table, to even have a table to put food on. When people look at their lives, there's this undercurrent of my life should have been perfect. My life, I should have my home paid for. I should have a good job that leaves me free and successful. I should have none of my kids be sick or ill or diseased or not deal with things. And that whole quest for perfection separates us from God, because the anger eventually goes either I'm not doing enough to earn his favor, or he's not being fair and giving me the goodies, so something's wrong here. I love the statement, you're not perfect. You were born to struggle.
Hello.
But you're worthy of love because the Father has deemed you so. The worthy of love, or even a parent to a child, you're worthy of being loved, not because you're the perfect child, not because you're first in the class, not because. You're worthy of love because, well, you just are.
See, I don't think we really come to know love until there is the acknowledgement and the admission of, yeah, I didn't quite earn this one. I think of the people that are on that endless treadmill performing for it. And there are people around that appreciate them. I don't see a settled security. I see an anxiety that has to keep that performance up.
Well, if you earn
it. I don't think they know the love. I mean, I think you really know God's love is honestly in moments of failure when you're just going like, oh, I totally blew that. And then to feel the breeze of his loving reality, knowing I blew that and he hasn't left me. That's a transformative moment if you can discern what's happening.
Yeah. And if you earn love, isn't it just a wage? It's just your salary. If love is a gift, I think that's what you're saying. When you realize that love is a gift, it's a gift that can be given. It's a gift that can be received. Just to love and care.
Sadly, something withheld.
About another human being. And yeah, there's a lot of people who don't feel worthy of love. She said, that's basically shame. We're not worthy of it. Maybe I didn't get it when I was younger. Maybe I didn't have a healthy parent relationship. And a lot of people didn't or don't. I get that email a lot too. But the idea that God is enough to embrace you in his love when you least deserve it.
See, I don't think most people know that.
No, I don't think religion teaches it.
And so I don't know if this lady gets into it, but it's like I imagine there's a bunch of people that go like, okay, yeah, I'm tracking. That's really great. But what do I do when I feel frightened, stuck in my shame, shields up, and the very thing that I want, which is relationship, even if they haven't defined it, I'm now preventing myself because I'm afraid And I don't know how to be vulnerable. I mean, I think, you know, we've talked about vulnerability. The root of it is able to be wounded. Not interested in being wounded.
Well, I think she defines vulnerability. I mean, that's the worst way to look at vulnerability.
Right.
It's true.
Okay.
But vulnerability is just the freedom to be who you are with all the imperfections that are in your life and to either be loved or not loved on a basis. Yeah.
Well, how did...
But the answer is go be vulnerable, which that's why I love the observations. I'm not sure that's the answer. The answer, I think, is go find out how loved you are by a father. When you're discovering that, you'll find that vulnerability is a great place to live. You don't have to guarantee the outcomes of your life. You can live in the uncertainty of the moment, even the uncertainty of what God is doing in a given situation or circumstance, and be at rest and not have to be panicked by, you know, whether everybody's going to like me or not. Because everybody's not going to like you. I think you can guarantee
that
in a fallen world. Yeah.
You know, because I love her analysis. I love her observations and insights. But I think that's where I'm going like, yeah, but if this is going to be of any meaningful help, it's the question of, okay, if vulnerability is key to relationship, and, okay, so we don't define it in the worst possible way, How do I have, because I think you need vulnerability even to discover that I'm loved by a father. I think you take all the other humans out of it. Go to the one guy who is safe. We don't know that. We still are hiding behind our fig leaves in our moment of, I screwed up and I'm in trouble. I mean, I look at my kids. My kids are loved children. But when they've done wrong, they all hide, and they all know.
I remember it well.
And their assumption is they're going to kill me. And you just go like, no, you do not have a murderous father and mother.
We've not killed you yet.
We have a long track record that you can appeal to. But it's like there is that impulse that you're just going like, okay, how do you not get stuck in that impulse to hide? I think tons of people are there.
Well, I think they are, but to me, as I understand God's revelation in the scriptures, God's come to make himself known, not just in the world. He comes to individual hearts to make himself known.
Right.
He invites us out of that scary little hiding place.
Right.
And we've got to see him. We've got to ask him, God, help me see you. Help me trust you enough. If that takes 2 years to trust you enough to take your hand to walk out of my dark closet, that's the process I'm in. That until that happens, little else that I do to try and win the world, to try and minister for God, to try and do anything else is going to have any impact or value. Start with, I've got to become certain of the love that this Father has for me that is unattached from my performance and is simply attached to what he values me to be as a human being.
I had God say something to me many years ago, and he said, Brad, you cannot serve me unless you trust me. And I'm sitting here going, in this passionate pursuit of, I'm embarking on being a servant of God, and I'm going like, okay, well, that puts me in a really terrible predicament, because chances are you wouldn't say that to me if I trusted you. Yeah. And that's my problem, is I realize I don't know how. And to put the two together, I'm going like, Lord, I'm wanting my life to serve you. And it's like, yeah, but unless you're settled and you know my love and I've won you to that place, all of that is not so much serving me as it is serving you.
And ultimately it will destroy you.
Yeah.
Yeah, all that work.
And I thought that was one of the really profound things that God said on the beginning of this, quote, professional ministry journey, where he's going like, he just did a leg sweep on the front end going like, great, glad you're passionate about me. Can we get back to square one, because you're about to head down a highway that is not going to work? And I had no clue.
Yeah.
And I had to, it's just like through a series of dreams, God just brought me to the place of, frankly, being undone, because I was trying to perform. I was trying to demonstrate my worth. I was trying. I mean, I even ended up in this one dream in a court scene trying to justify why I should go do this. And every answer I gave was no, no, no.
Nice try.
To a point where all of a sudden I had nothing else to say. And I was in this encounter. I was absolutely undone and full of despair in that moment, because I was like, oh, I got nothing. And the Lord spoke in the midst of it, said, because I love you. That was his starting point. It wasn't go earn my love and come back and I'll give you the kudos. It's if we don't start from there, everything that goes off in that other direction really is that futility.
Yeah, that's Jesus' baptism, my beloved son in whom I'm well pleased. Before he'd done anything that we would say is Matter. Quote unquote ministry related. You are my beloved son. Paul writes to the Colossians, even when he's telling him, you know, don't be angry anymore and forgive. And he starts out with saying, now as God's children, holy and dearly loved. If you don't start there, then even any act of external righteousness is going to just be a performance thing that will destroy you.
Yes, serving your own need to be justified. And I think so often the most religiously industrious is really someone who is running in hot pursuit away from their shame, trying to come up with ammunition to defend themselves against what they feel.
Yeah, and if you're not there, if you don't know what that is, and I know people, I mean, I'm hiding in this dark closet. I can't hear God. I don't feel him. I don't know his love. I don't. And they're looking for just the right three-step deal, the right little nugget of truth, the right little. And I think what you're underscoring, and people say, I never had a dream like that. I don't have a dream like that. You know, let God come to you the way he deems best to come to you. But don't look for what you need to make the next step to come from some external source, even from a podcast like this or a book.
Didn't have the dream because I knew I needed the dream, and I was striving for the dream. I was going like, I didn't have a clue what I was about to embark on.
Yeah, but I get to email it to him. I never have a dream. God never gives me a dream like that. I say, you know what? Wherever you are in your dark place of invulnerability or a refusal to be vulnerable and to risk, it is going to be a risk to put your hand in the hand of the Father's and say, you know what, I want to learn to live this way. And it will take him speaking to your heart in a way you understand that says, I do love you. You're my son. You're my daughter. Let's live out of that. Let's not live out of.
I think to have a genuine encounter with God, I think you have something going on in our culture that's really weird. Is there's a lot of people who I think are trying to redefine God as just this ultra nice and nothing of judgment, truth, or whatever. They're taking all the hard things out. And no, he's just this great teddy bear. And you're just going like, no, I don't read the Bible and come up with that conclusion. I go like, wait a minute, that's not quite right. And I think that is just as motivated as an attempt to escape shame. I'm just going to redefine God in a way that makes me feel better. No, to know the living God, I think you got to come to him in a way that just says, all right, God, this is what I am. I'm being honest with that as best I can.
And that's where he gets to make himself known. Thank you for joining us today on The God Journey. If you'd like to participate in the conversation, you may do so at our website, thegodjourney.com.